From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, the life of a made member of the Mafia. Nicholas Caramandi rose through the ranks of the Philadelphia mob. His specialties included extortion, loan sharking, buying union leaders and elected officials, and planning murders. Now he's in the Federal Witness Protection Program. Caramandi will join us by phone. In the studio, we'll have George Anastasia, who writes about organized crime for the Philadelphia Inquirer and is the author of a book about the Philadelphia mob. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the latest album from composer and pianist Mel Waldron. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush unveiled his health care package today before Cleveland's Chamber of Commerce. From member station WKSU in Kent, Ohio, Kevin Niedermeyer reports.
Under President Bush's plan, families could use tax credits and deductions of up to $3,750 to buy private health insurance or buy into an employer's health care plan. The proposal also calls for cutting costs by limiting the awards in malpractice suits and by reducing waste and excess in the medical field. The president gave no specifics on how he planned to pay for his proposal, but said controlling the cost of Medicare and Medicaid would be a start.
We can make real savings simply by reducing this huge rate of increase. We must bring runaway costs under control.
The president will be in San Diego tomorrow to discuss preventative health care. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Niedermeyer in Cleveland.
The Spanish government has accused Basque separatists of planting a car bomb that killed 5 people and wounded 7 today in Madrid. The bomb killed the occupants of a military minibus and wounded passers-by in the street. Spanish Prime Minister Felipe González charged that Basque separatists are using terror tactics in an effort to blackmail authorities before the 1992 Summer Olympics in Barcelona. No groups immediately claimed responsibility for the bombing. Spanish authorities say it may be the work of ETA, an acronym for the Basque Liberty and Homeland Party. The United States has resumed the repatriation of 12,000 Haitian boat people from its naval base at Guantanamo in Cuba. The controversial program was held up for 24 hours after Haiti's military rulers asked for it to be slowed down. From Port-au-Prince, NPR's Alan Tomlinson has more.
The Coast Guard cutters Bear and Northland pulled into port, each with 250 Haitians on board. U.S. immigration officials in Guantanamo have classified them as economic migrants with no claim to political asylum. The refugees filed dejectedly onto the grimy docks of their native land, carrying their belongings in plastic bags. They were met by the Red Cross, which gave them money for the bus journey home, and by Haitian police and immigration officials who interviewed, fingerprinted, and sometimes photographed them. The U.S. government believes the returned boat people have nothing to fear from this. Washington says there's no evidence the military-backed regime, which took power in a coup here, plans reprisals against those who fled the subsequent repression. Human rights groups, including Amnesty International, disagree. In Haiti, I'm Alan Tomlinson reporting.
Stock prices closed slightly lower today after a session of mixed trading on Wall Street. Analysts said the market has been correcting itself after this week's record high. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 2 points to close at 3,255.59. Advances led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR. Recent surveys in Poland indicate that Poles are increasingly disenchanted with the government's economic austerity program. A poll conducted by the state television service found that about 68% of Polish citizens believe the nation is going in the wrong direction. The government's austerity program has slowed inflation and improved the supply of goods in Polish stores, but unemployment is high and prices are rising faster than wages. So far, 16 people have been confirmed dead after a military plane crashed into a hotel and restaurant in Evansville, Indiana. Trish Muse of member station WNIN in Evansville reports.
A C-130 military aircraft crashed into the restaurant and then immediately exploded, setting fire to a neighboring hotel. Traveling businessman Jeff Butler saw the crash.
I noticed it being awful low, and I looked up and it just kind of made a... It angled and then just nosedived straight down. And then I seen the big mushroom cloud of flame.
Hotel residents were hanging out their windows trying to escape the flames. The fiery impact of the plane caused a chain reaction of explosions of cars in the hotel parking lot. For National Public Radio, I'm Trish Muse in Evansville, Indiana.
The latest figures on infant mortality show that the United States continued to improve, but that there are still wide disparities in the death rates for black and white babies. The figures date from 1989, the most recent year for which statistics are available. During that year, the U.S. infant death rate was 9.8 deaths by age 1 for every 1,000 live births. At the same time, the black infant mortality rate was 18.6, compared with 8.1% for whites. The leading cause of death for white infants was birth defects. For black infants, it was prematurity or low birth weight. An official for the Centers for Disease Control said that increased use of prenatal care could have the greatest impact on infant deaths. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The government is trying to break up the New York Mafia, and they're about to get two more cracks at it. In one trial now underway, several members of the Gambino crime family are charged with extorting a mob tax in the garment industry. And John Gotti, the reputed head of the family, is about to stand trial for the murder of crime boss Paul Castellano. Perhaps the city in which the law scored its greatest recent victories over the mob is Philadelphia. The city's number one crime family was broken up. Its leader, Nicky Scarfo, is in prison. One of the men who helped put him away is Nicholas Caramandi. Also known as Nicky the Crow, he used to be one of Scarfo's closest associates. Caramandi was a made member of the mafia, but when he found out Scarfo was ready to turn against him, Caramandi joined the Federal Witness Protection Program and gave testimony that was essential to the prosecution's case. You're about to hear his first broadcast interview since he went into hiding with his new identity. He spoke to us yesterday by phone from an undisclosed location. In the studio was George Anastasia, who covers organized crime for the Philadelphia Inquirer and is the author of a book about the Scarfo family called Blood and Honor. Caramandi was his primary inside source. Anastasia says the Scarfo family was the bloodiest and most violent in the country, but it wasn't the largest.
Well, the Philadelphia crime family was relatively small compared to New York, only 60, 65 made members. But it was important because of its location and because Atlantic City fell into its orbit. And that gave the family a lot more status. And traditionally, the family, particularly when it was run by Angelo Bruno, Bruno sat on the commission in New York, which was the mafia ruling body. And Bruno had very good connections with the late Carlo Gambino. And that also enhanced the status of the Philadelphia family. And in the 80s, after Bruno was killed and Scarfo became the boss, basically the family became a shoot-'em-up kind of organization. And that brought, ultimately, a lot of problems to Philadelphia and to the organization. And an argument can be made that what happened in Philadelphia had a negative impact on the families in New York.
There's one big crime family trial that just got started in New York, and John Gotti will be coming to trial again very soon. How do you see the Philadelphia mob as connecting with these two New York trials?
Well, there's a couple of different things. One of the key witnesses in the Gotti trial will be Philip Leonetti, who was the underboss in Philadelphia, and who flipped and became a government witness as a result of his prosecutions down here. And Nick Caramandi was one of the main witnesses in those prosecutions. The other, I think, interesting parallel on a broader level is the family in Philadelphia and what happened down here and the parallels to what's happening in New York. And the kind of the irony that Philadelphia was run by Nicky Scarfo, who was rather flamboyant, rather violent, and kind of ignored the traditional mob values, if values is the word, that ensured the mafia's continuation for decades. And there was a lot of comparisons between Scarfo's management style and the management style of John Gotti, the celebrity mobster, the flamboyance, the almost, in-your-face kind of attitude. I mean, Gotti succeeded for the last, I think, three times he's been tried and has succeeded. Scarfo had much the same approach, but Scarfo was convicted. Scarfo, in fact, was the first American mafia boss ever convicted of first-degree murder. And he's in jail now for probably the rest of his life.
No, Nicholas Caramandi is going to join us in a moment on the phone. How would you describe his place in the Philadelphia crime family? What was it?
I think Nick was a major player in the the Philadelphia organization. At the end, he was, what they say, with the boss direct. He was directly with Scarfo. He was Scarfo's guy. And that put him right next to Scarfo. And he was probably the point man in labor racketeering and union corruption for the organization. And prior to that, he was involved in several organized crime hits or murders and was a part of the violence that kind of set the tone in Philadelphia.
Now, he was the major source for your book, Blood and Honor, about the Scarfo mob.
Right.
How did you first hook up with him?
Nick hooked up with me, which I think is indicative of Nick's ability to do things and get things done.
Well, maybe I should introduce him here and ask him to tell the story. Nicholas Caramandi, welcome to Fresh Air.
How you doing?
Hi. Let me ask you to tell the story of why you called George Anastasia.
Well, I used to read a lot of George's articles in the newspaper, the Inquirer, and he was a pretty good writer, and he was very familiar with the players, you know, of the because of the trials and so forth and so on. So I figured I'd get somebody local, you know. Then I reached out and got him, you know.
Why'd you want to tell your story in the first place?
Well, I wanted to make some money. I wanted to write a book to make some money. That's the reason.
Have you made money?
Not really. Not as much as I expected to, but, you know, there's always hope.
How do you like your life in the witness protection program? And how protected do you feel?
Pretty well. Pretty good. Pretty well protected. I'm pretty well protected.
How would you compare your life to what it was when you were in the Scarfo family?
Zero now. It's nothing. It's horrible.
What's horrible about it?
The lifestyle. I mean, I just can't seem to adapt to this lifestyle. You know, for all my life, I did things, and, you know, above the law, and now I have to be a citizen, you know, an upright citizen, and that's pretty tough. You got to be on alert all the time. You got to act like just another sucker, you know what I mean?
Now, you once said that you decided to join the Witness Protection Program because when you were in prison, you found out that you were going to be murdered. Who was going to get you and why?
Well, the reason was I was involved in a big extortion, what they call the Rouse extortion. And I had a guy, this fellow that wore a wire for about a year, and he was taping my conversations. But he never had anything else than this Rouse extortion, because I discussed it with him one time, and not in too much detail. But with the year of the wiretapping, that's all he had. So I got arrested consequently because of that. That helped, you know, in some of the cooperation with the extortion. Now, there was a councilman involved in his aide. So there were some problems that one of these fellows was going to flip the councilman's aide, and with me out of the case, I guess they felt safe. And I had this proven to me that Scarfo gave me up and just wanted me dead out of the picture, and they would have had no case against these with this councilman and his aide. So this is the reason why.
So you think Scarfo knew that you were planning to testify? Is that what you're saying? I'm sorry.
No. I wasn't planning to testify on anybody. I mean, it was the furthest thing from my mind on testifying. But when I heard definitely that I was going to be killed, and I knew Scarfo's rhythm, you know, I knew his mood. Once he turned on you, you know, it's all over. And I got this from another made member that told me while I was in prison. So I knew I had a problem, you know. And there's only one way you get out of this thing, and that's in a box. You know, you can't ever quit. And I just thought I was going to be killed in prison.
If you're just joining us on the telephone, is Nicholas Caramandi, who was a made member of the Philadelphia mob, joined the Federal Witness Protection Program and helped break the Philadelphia mob. Also with me is George Anastasia, who's a reporter who reports on organized crime for the Philadelphia Inquirer and has written about the crime families here for many years. Anastasia is the author of a new book called Blood and Honor about the Scarfo mob, and Nicholas Caramandi was one of his main sources for the book. Nicholas Caramandi, the last quote in George Anastasia's book is by you, and you basically say that you blame the downfall of the Philadelphia mob on Scarfo himself, on the leader of the mob. What was wrong with him as a leader?
Well, he didn't look too closely at his men. He didn't, single them out and see the problems within. We had so many problems within, and he didn't see these things that were hidden from him. And sometimes when he found out, it was too late. You understand? This is the reason why I blame him. I mean, he should have took a closer look at things, you know, instead of make, you know, fast judgments and harsh judgments against certain members that were killed, particularly one fellow, Salvatore Testa, who was a very dedicated member, the most dedicated member I ever been around and I ever seen. And over the years, what this fellow did to this Philadelphia family was really remarkable. And here's a guy got killed for nothing.
Well, he not only got killed.
Other people's, excuse me?
I was saying he not only got killed, you were one of the people who had to help kill him.
Yes. Well, that's the way it is. You know, this thing comes first. This thing of ours is, it comes before your mother, your father, your sister, your brother, your wife. It comes before anything. So you have to learn how to deal with that and how to cope with that.
Well, Testa was a friend of yours, so when Scarfo ordered him killed, what was your reaction?
I felt bad about it, but I knew it was coming. You know, it wasn't a surprise to me. It was only a matter of time. I knew it was coming, and I just felt bad about it, very, very bad about it. But there was nothing I could do.
Any way you could have said no?
No. You don't say no. You can't never say no. If you say no, it's all over for you. You don't say no. The boss comes first. Like I said, this thing comes first. Whatever reasons there were, you don't question the boss. When the boss talks, you listen. Don't worry, sometimes I was tempted to tell him, why don't you just take it on a hop, but I couldn't.
Why not?
I just couldn't. I mean, you know, that's not the way we live. That's not the way this thing works, you know. When the decision was made, you just have to abide by it. And I just couldn't. So that's something you have to live with.
We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk more about the mafia. This is Fresh Air. Joining us on the telephone is Nicholas Caramandi, a former initiated member of the Philadelphia Mafia. He testified against the mob and is now in the Federal Witness Protection Program. In the studio is George Anastasia. He covers organized crime for the Philadelphia Inquirer and is the author of a book about the Philadelphia mob called Blood and Honor. You know, it's hard for a lot of people to understand, and maybe you can help explain it, how people could be so committed to kind of keeping the code, because there's this ethic and there's this code of silence and you keep it up. But yet it's okay to murder, and even to murder your friend if you're asked to do it by the head of the crime family.
Yes, that's the way it is. That's why I said that it's a special breed of men. I mean, you could be a killer, you could be anything, and you just can't get into the mob. I mean, you could be a tough guy, you could knock out tough 10 guys, it doesn't mean anything. Something, you got to be chosen, something about the person, and this is the reason why you're chosen. Like I said, you have to be, it's a special breed of men. You know, there was only 60 of us in Philadelphia, in the Philadelphia crime family, and we ruled like 20 million people. You know, we must have had like 1,000, maybe 10, 15,000 people with us. You know, associates, you know, do what makes us strong. And this is the way it is, you know. You just can't join. join. It's not something you join. You're chosen.
Nick, let me ask you. You were a made man. How did your life change after the initiation ceremony? What was different about your work and the way people treated you?
Well, I tell everybody else, it's like dying and going to heaven when you become a made member. When that day comes and you have your ceremony, and the prestige, the honor, you're part of something. You're part of power. You're part of smoking guns. Like it's so strong, you know, within you. That moment is so big in your life. It's just like I said. It's like dying and going to heaven. You're part of something. I mean, you're not just part of the Philadelphia Crime Family. You're part of the whole United States. You're like in the government. You're like a second government. You're power. You know, you have power over life and death. You have power. I mean, doors open for you where they would never open. I mean, now you could practically do anything you want within your ability. You help people. You got people that belong to you now, associates that come to you for favors. I mean, it's just enormous. There's no limit of what you could do as far as money-making according to your ability. I mean, there's nothing to stop you. I mean, doors just opened that could never open for the average person.
What do you think of as being your greatest contribution to the Scarfo family?
My greatest contribution?
Mm-hmm.
I, as a person, I was nothing. I mean, it's not me. It's the world around me that's so strong. Just being a member, I mean, there's no contribution. I mean, we don't contribute anything. You know what I'm saying? We're just part of something, you know?
Yeah, but you had your specialties.
Specialties in what? You mean...
in making money.
Oh, and things that I've done?
Yeah.
Well, you keep your money. You know, I mean, I've done a lot of things. You know, I extorted people. I extorted hundreds of people. So forth and so on. But it doesn't mean anything. You know, that doesn't make me better than the next soldier. You know, we're all the same. We're all one.
So let me just get back to something I asked you before. What was the difference? How did your day-to-day life change in terms of the activities that you were involved in for the Scarfo family after you became a made man?
Well, I was pretty active. I mean, I always had five or six things going at one time. And I never worked, you know, for 25 years. I didn't work. I just made a living stealing. But... like I said, the doors opened for me, and I seen things, and I took advantage of my position to earn. You understand what I'm saying? I was in the loan shark business. I was in construction business, unions, some drug extortions, you know, things like that. Anywhere where the money was, any opportunity that I see. Saw unions, like I was going to go down Atlantic City and establish health and welfare benefits from unions and try to start some unions with the dealers and the casinos. And I had a lot of things going, you know. And like I said, there was nothing in the way to stop me because I had permission, you know, from the boss.
George, how much was the Philadelphia mob involved in the construction of the casinos in Atlantic City?
Well, I think it's already been documented that the first five or six casinos, the subcontracting work, the concrete work, the reinforced steel work, was done by mob-connected construction companies. There's also a fascinating story that a labor investigator tells about a fellow who was assigned to basically be the paycheck controller on a construction site in a trailer on one of the casino sites, and he took charge of the time clocks. And what he was doing it was a corrupt union, and what he was basically doing was cheating the membership by doctoring the numbers so that as the union prevailing wage and health and welfare benefit wouldn't have to be paid. In addition, out of the trailer, he was running a sports bookmaking operation, and he would bring prostitutes in for the workers on their lunch breaks. So, I mean, it was indicative of the way the mob operates. There was an opportunity, or several opportunities, and they moved in and took advantage of them. And there's any number of ways in which they made money in Atlantic City. That was one of them. The other is that they corrupted the bartenders union and basically controlled that for 12 or 15 years.
Nicholas Caramandi, what was the biggest money-making scheme that you were involved with in Atlantic City?
In Atlantic City? Oh, well, we were about to start the unions, the health and welfare, and getting the dealers organized. So that would have been millions and millions of dollars per year that we would have made. Just with the health and welfare benefits, it was like millions, you understand? And that's something like a member has to pay like $28, $30 a month for his health and welfare benefits. And what I was going to do is set up five or six satellite doctors, you know, in that area in a 30, 40, 50-mile radius where the people lived. And if the family got sick, they could go to the doctor. And in other words, you pay a doctor, say, $1,000 a month if he sees one patient, or if he sees 50 patients, he still gets that $1,000 a month. So when you consider 20, 40,000 people, you know, that are in the union at $30 a piece a month, you know, you're talking a lot of money. You're talking millions and millions.
The deal basically was the doctor was going to kick back to you guys, right, Nick?
In other words, the doctor was going to work for us, and he just was going to be the front man. You understand? And that's how that would have worked.
How much money did you think you were going to make off of the Atlantic City unions if the plan went through?
Oh, plenty. I mean, there's no telling. I know some members, I know of members that when they died, they had $40, $50, $60 million in properties. And, I mean, motels and estates and horses, you know. Some of them were very, very smart with their brain and knew how to, you know, how to peak, how to make that money. And there just was no telling. You know, I had a deal in Atlantic City just with construction that came to $250 million that I would have been in control of. I would have put the contractors in who I wanted to put in, because the people that were part of the project were going to give me the bids with the other contractors' bid. I would have had the last bid, and I would have underbid them and gave it to the contractor that I wanted at maybe a flat fee of maybe 5% of the job, gross of the job. If the job was $20 million, he had to give me 5% of that, or maybe 10%, depending. And that's the way it would have went.
George, do you want to add anything about extent to which the Philadelphia mob penetrated the unions?
Well, I think what Nick is explaining is basically what they become is expediters, and they make things happen, and they extract a fee to expedite things. If you know that you're going to have the low bid, you'll be willing to pay a fee to ensure that you get the contract. And that's what they did in Atlantic City, and it's what they did in Philadelphia, and it's what they do in New York. It's they make things happen for a fee.
Nicholas Caramandi is a former member of the Philadelphia Mob. He's now in the Federal Witness Protection Program. George Anastasia covers organized crime for the Philadelphia Inquirer and is the author of the book Blood and Honor. They'll both be back with us in the second part of our show to talk about drug money and murder in the mafia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the five rules a made man in the mafia has to follow. We continue our conversation with Nicholas Caramandi, a former member of the Philadelphia mob who is now in the Federal Witness Protection Program. One of those rules is don't deal drugs. But we'll find out how Caramandi made big money from drugs without actually selling them. Also with us will be George Anastasia, who writes about organized crime for the Philadelphia Inquirer and has written a book about the Philadelphia mob. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album by pianist and composer Mal Waldron. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Congressional Democrats responded to the president's health care plan today by calling it woefully inadequate, unresponsive, and full of gimmicks. While Republicans praised the president for joining the health debate, few offered unqualified support for his plan. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell said today the question is no longer whether there's a problem, it is now what should be done. President Bush offered his market-based health care reform proposals today, which were immediately condemned by congressional Democrats as inadequate. House Majority Leader Richard Gephardt.
That will put more money in the pockets of insurance companies and doctors, but will do nothing to make health care coverage affordable or ensure that all Americans have access to quality care.
Republicans praised the program as a beginning, but predicted a long and difficult debate ahead. Public opinion polls show that Americans rate health insurance as the second most worrisome economic problem and that they trust the Democrats over the president to reform the system. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Secretary of State James Baker meets tomorrow with the Israeli ambassador to talk about the status of proposed $10 billion loan guarantees to provide housing for Soviet Jews. The Bush administration has been delaying a decision on the loan guarantees, which have cast a shadow over the Middle Eastern peace process. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Secretary of State James Baker today declined to say if the Bush administration would approve loan guarantees to help Israel absorb an influx of Jewish immigrants. But he did hint strongly about conditions the U.S. could attach to the guarantees. Speaking before the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Baker said the Bush administration supports the loan guarantees in principle, but he strongly linked their approval to suspending Jewish settlements and to the Middle East peace process. The administration says continued settlements are an obstacle to peace, but Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir has so far rejected linkage between the loan guarantees and building more settlements in the occupied territories. But without the guarantees, Israel will be hard-pressed to absorb the 1 million Jewish immigrants coming from the former Soviet Union. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
A military transport plane on training exercises crashed this morning at Evansville, Indiana, and at least 16 people were killed. Officials say that the plane hit a restaurant and motel, killing at least 11 people on the ground. The C-130 airplane from the National Guard in Kentucky hit the buildings about 1 mile from the airport, heavily damaging both structures. An airport spokesman said the plane was doing touch-and-go exercises, in which an airplane barely touches the runway and then returns to the air. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 2 points to close at 3,255. This is NPR News. U.S. officials have resumed their efforts to send more than 10,000 Haitian boat people back home. Under an agreement reached yesterday between U.S. and Haitian officials, Coast Guard cutters will drop off refugees 3 times a week. Under this schedule, it will take about 7 weeks to return all those picked up at sea. Red Cross officials give all those sent home $15 in bus fare and a card entitling them to food aid. There has been sharp criticism from human rights advocates who say that those sent back to Haiti could face persecution by the military-backed government. The president of Croatia has unconditionally accepted a UN peacekeeping plan aimed at ending the civil war in Yugoslavia. Acceptance of the plan removes one important roadblock to peace in the country. NPR's Jim Zeroli reports.
In a letter to the UN released today, Croatian President Franjo Tudjman said he unconditionally accepted all aspects of the peace plan. As recently as last week, Tudjman had rejected the plan, partly because he objected to UN supervision of police in areas of heavy fighting. But Tudjman changed his mind after heavy pressure from the European community, especially Germany. His reversal leaves just one more Yugoslavian leader opposing the plan. That is Milan Babic of Krajina, a region of Croatia dominated by Serbs. UN officials say once all sides agree to the plan, peacekeeping troops will be dispatched to Yugoslavia. Some European communities want the UN to deploy some troops immediately, but UN officials say it's still too soon. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
A car bomb explosion in Spain has killed 5 people and injured 7 others. The bomb went off as a military minibus was passing by, and it killed all those inside the bus. The explosion occurred near military staff headquarters in Madrid. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Nicholas Caramandi was an initiated member of the Philadelphia Mafia, but when the head of the crime family, Nicky Scarfo, ordered Caramandi's murder, Caramandi joined the Federal Witness Protection Program and helped bring the family down. He's going to tell us about drug money and murder in the Mafia. This is the second half of an interview we recorded yesterday. Caramandi spoke by phone from an undisclosed location. In the studio was George Anastasia, who covers organized crime for the Philadelphia Inquirer and is the author of a book about the Philadelphia mob called Blood and Honor. I asked Caramandi about the Philadelphia mob's stand on dealing drugs.
Well, we're not allowed to get directly involved in drugs. We have rules when we get made, when we get at the ceremony. We're given rules, and the rule, and we had 4 or 5 major rules that were told by the boss: no drug involvement, no kidnapping, no counterfeit money, no phony bonds, no pimping, and a few other rules like we can't fight amongst ourselves. We can't, if we punch another member or take a punch at another member, that could cause immediate death. I mean, the person that you hit, he could ask for your life and get it in some cases. But as far as your question about drugs, our thing was this: we could extort them, we could loan them money, they could pay us protection, and if they don't want to do that, we could kill them. They have no help. Nobody could help them, the drug dealer.
So you made a lot of money off of drugs, even though you weren't dealing drugs?
No, I made a lot of money, from drug dealers, from payoffs that they had to pay me off to operate, you know, because of their illegal activities with drugs. And but we could not get involved with drugs directly ourselves.
So, George, let me ask you, though the Scarfo family wasn't dealing drugs, what impact do you think they had on the drug climate in Philadelphia?
Well, Philadelphia for a long time was the methamphetamine capital of the East Coast. And you had motorcycle gangs involved in the manufacturing of methamphetamine, and you had street-level dealers and other quasi-wise guys involved. The mob became, in a lot of times, the financier for the importation of P2P, which is the chemical that you need to manufacture meth. And also, at the other end, they were collecting what Nick is referring to as kind of a street tax of something like $2,000 for each gallon of P2P that was brought into the country. So they would loan a drug dealer money to go out and buy the P2P. And after he brought the P2P in, manufactured the meth, they would be collecting a street tax. So they were getting money on both ends. And they, while they weren't directly involved in drugs, they were certainly a major part of the whole process. And I think also, and I think Nick would acknowledge this, that there were guys who on the sly got involved in drug deals, either members or associates who weren't supposed to be involved, but because the opportunity was there, would work a drug deal here and there.
Is that right, Nick?
Yes, at times they would sneak in. At times that would happen. But it meant death. I mean, if you got caught being directly involved.
So if you had your way, would you have been allowed to deal drugs directly?
Well, I dealt drugs before I got it, when I was an associate, you know, for a while. But no, that's the rule. I mean, technically, you cannot deal drugs, and there's good reasons why you shouldn't. course, this rule works all over the United States, not just in Philly, with the Philadelphia family, with other families, because it brings too much heat, drugs. Brings too much. You got FBI, DEA, and it just brings too much heat upon the families. And they don't need that kind of publicity, that kind of heat.
But don't you get the heat anyways when you're involved with the drug dealers and practicing extortion on them?
If I loan him money, what do I know what he's going to do with the money? If he says, if somebody comes to me and says they need $50,000, I don't ask him what he does with the money. I don't want to know that he's buying drugs for it. He ain't going to tell me he's going to. He can't come to me and say, look, I'm going to buy drugs for it. I need $50,000. Okay. In other words, I don't care what you do with the money, but I want $100,000 back, and I want a piece of whatever you're doing. You understand what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And this is how we operate. So they needed us in some ways, and you had these guys that had hidden, and, you know, these hidden drug dealers that didn't want to pay, and we had to go dig them out. We used to dig them out. They decided to pay. Then we protected them somewhat. If they had a problem here and there, maybe some people owed them money or something, then we would try to collect the money for them. And, you know, they still had our help. I mean, we could help them that way. But to be directly involved, we couldn't. You know, to say, here's $50,000, I'm your partner in the drug business, we couldn't do that.
What about doing drugs? Did you do drugs?
No. Are you kidding? That's a no-no. That's immediate death. If you even caught with a drug... That's immediate death. These are rules. These are rules that are laid down. I mean, you can't break these rules. You have to stay with these rules. I mean, ain't whiskey powerful enough? You know, we got champagne and whiskey to drink. We don't need drugs. We had enough problems containing ourselves with the booze than dealing with drugs or taking drugs. Maybe a few took it here and there. I don't know. But they're not going to tell me. Understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But I doubt it's very unlikely.
George, were you going to add something?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing, and this is something that fascinated me the whole time that I've been talking to Nick and gotten to know Nick, is, you know, the reason for not dealing drugs or the reasons for doing anything have very little to do with morality, as you could see from what he said. I mean, it's the question of you don't do it because it brings heat and it causes problems. It's not a question of right or wrong. And that's one of the fascinating things, fascinating in kind of a bizarre kind of way. I remember sitting with Nick talking about a couple of the murders he was involved in, and we were sitting in a motel room down in Ocean City, Maryland, and he started to get involved in describing this one attempted hit down in South Philly, and he got out one of these legal pads and started drawing like a diagram like he was Joe Paterno doing an off-tackle slant, and he was basically talking about an attempt to kill somebody. But that's, you know, to him, it just was, it's what they did. And it wasn't a question of was it morally right or wrong. Nick lived on the other side of that line, and if you stepped over that line, you were part of that, you knew what the rules were, and this is the way the life was.
Nick, what do you think of what George is saying?
That's true. George is absolutely correct.
My guest is Nicholas Caramandi, who's in the Federal Witness Protection Program, and journalist George Anastasia. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is George Anastasia, who's a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer and has covered the mob for many years and has written a new book called Blood and Honor about the Scarfo crime family in Philadelphia. And Nicky Scarfo is behind bars now, and one of the people who helped put him there is Nicholas Caramandi, who's now in the Federal Witness Protection Program. He's joining us on the telephone, and he's also the main source for the new book, Blood and Honor. In the whole time that you were in the Scarfo family, was there ever anyone who you felt you could trust completely? Or did you always have to worry about somebody stabbing you in the back in some way or another?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I had a couple birds that tried to get me killed, maybe four or five. And you can't trust no one. You just can't. You never know, you know. I had a couple birds that tried to get me killed, a couple associates that tried to get me killed a few times. Got to put you in traps. Like I said, certain people are jealous, and the animosity and the depth of this thing is so deep. You know, Let me say this to you. The tongue was made to hide your thoughts. And some people could use their tongue so cleverly that you just don't know what they're thinking, ever know what they're thinking. And you might think they're your greatest friend in the world, but they're not. Because their tongue, the way they use it, you know, just hides anything that's in their mind. So I learned that a long time ago.
You know, I meant to ask you, how many people would you estimate you were involved in killing?
Well, directly four, maybe another four or five helped set up. You know.
Were there any of those where you actually pulled the trigger yourself?
No, didn't have a chance to. Didn't have the opportunity. I had the gun in my hand 1,000 times, but I just didn't have the opportunity.
You mean somebody else did it first, or what?
Yeah, well, you know, just didn't have the opportunity to pull it because certain things happen, and I just didn't have the opportunity to pull it.
Where is a hitman in the organization? Is that like a very well-respected high position, or is that considered lower down, something that you kind of move up from?
No, everybody has to kill. Everybody, everybody in this organization has to kill. I mean, if they have to use somebody that has to kill the person, they use that person. You understand?
Well, you have to kill before you become a made man.
Excuse me?
You have to kill before you get initiated.
Yes, you have to be part of a murder before you get get made, you know. That's the way it works. You have to participate in a murder. Sometimes the first time you might have to pull the trigger. Sometimes you might be the getaway driver. Sometimes you might set the person up. You might bring them to a restaurant. And because of that, you get down. It all depends upon the situation. And that's the way it works, you know. There's nobody gets any points for killing more people. I told you, everybody's equal. Everybody's the same. Nobody has special privileges. You understand that if you killed 50 people, it doesn't mean nothing. You're still treated the same. If you didn't kill nobody or if you killed 50, we're all equal. Because you never know. You might have to kill 5 guys in the next 2 weeks. You know, you might be the guy that might have to do that. Well, that's the way it works.
What was your job in the murder of Sal Testa, who was the person who was closest to you?
First I was the shooter, but I tried 17 different times, 17 different attempts. The closest I came to killing him was in a funeral parlor when I had the gun in my jacket. I looked at Scarfo and the younger boys, Foley and Eddie, and they gave me the off sign. His back was toward me, his head was toward me, and I was going to shoot him in the head, but they gave me the off sign because there was too many cops outside. We were supposed to kill him in this funeral parlor. Upstairs they had a bar, and we all went upstairs, about 25 members, maybe 20, 25 associates, and just having a few drinks, but that was the spot we were supposed to kill him. And it just didn't work. You know, they called it off. So this is the way this thing works. I mean, there's nobody better than anybody else. You have to be able to pull the trigger.
For the actual murder, where were you?
Excuse me?
During the actual...
Away. When he actually was murdered, a block away. And see, I had some difficulty because I was pretty close to him, and I just couldn't be in a place that he was that would be obvious that I shouldn't be. And that would have gave him a signal. You understand? It was very difficult to get him. I mean, we could have got him easy. I could have got him in my neighborhood where we were hanging, but they didn't want to do it that way because we worried about the FBI. We worried about pictures they were taking. And, you know, we worried about an unforeseen in the neighborhood. But outside of the neighborhood was difficult because, you know, I just couldn't be in a position where all of a sudden I appeared. You understand? I mean, there were 17 different times that we tried, tennis courts and restaurants and, you know, different places that we knew he went, and I just couldn't get him. You know, I mean, we wanted him with the guns to shoot, and sometimes he wouldn't show. This is what happens, you know. But eventually, once they got the ticket on you, it's pretty hard to escape. If it takes a week, if it takes a month, if it takes 6 months, it doesn't make any difference. If it's It's not a rush. They don't ask you to rush unless it's an emergency where they want it done right away, you know. But they usually you use your own discretion and try to get the best spot, you know.
George, you were going to add something?
Well, I think of all the murders, and there must be 25 or 30 murders that occurred between 80 and 85, that the Salvi Testa killing was probably the most indicative of the most treacherous and the most symbolic of all the killings. Testa had helped Scarfo solidify his hold on the family, and once Scarfo was the king, he looked around and I think he saw Salvi Testa as his rival. And the irony is that they used probably Salvi's best friend to set him up. They lured him to a candy shop, and there was somebody waiting with a gun, and they blew a hole in the back of his head. And then Nick was involved in disposing of the body after that. But another, you know, the irony and the bitterness and the treachery and all kind of surfaced in any one murder. It's the Salvi Testa murder. And I heard a story that after this, the fellow who did the shooting would stop into a sandwich shop that the Salvi's best friend owned, the fellow who set Salvi up, and would just go up to the jukebox and put a quarter in and play the song "That's What Friends Are For" and walk out of the sandwich shop. Hmm. Just that kind of irony and kind of sticking it to somebody, you know.
George, do you worry about anybody trying to use you to get to Nicholas Caramandi?
Well, I've made a point of not knowing where Nick is. I can't call him. He calls me. I have no idea where in the country he's living. And I've made a point of doing that so that I won't be away for anybody to find out where Nick is. Because he definitely has a security problem. I mean, there are people who would like to see him eliminated. And it's best that he stays in the background.
George Anastasia covers organized crime for the Philadelphia Inquirer and is the author of the book Blood and Honor, published by Morrow. Nicholas Caramandi is a former member of the Philadelphia mob, now in the Federal Witness Protection Program. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on the president's health plan?
Well, Patricia Naimond, who covers health care and health care economics for us, will be analyzing what the president proposed today, a plan that relies on the private insurance industry, but also would offer tax credits and deductions for people who are uninsured to pay for their individual and family health insurance. Also today, we will be talking with Francis Fukuyama, the author of The End of History and The Last Man. It's a book expanding on a controversial essay that he wrote a couple of years ago in which he says that liberal democracy really is the end point of history as historians have understood it for the past couple of centuries.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz pianist Mal Waldron has been playing music for a long time. Early in his career, he organized jam session records featuring saxophonist John Coltrane. He played with bassist Charles Mingus and was Billie Holiday's last accompanist. Since then, he's mostly played his own music with a wide variety of groups. He now lives in Munich. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says that despite Waldron's travels and broad experience, there's something unshakably consistent about his work.
Pianist Mal Waldron hit on an original concept in the mid-1950s, and he's stuck to it pretty much ever since. As Waldron describes it, he may take two or three notes and milk them dry before moving on to the next few and doing the same thing with them. Waldron says he repeats phrases so he'll be clear in his own mind about what he's played already before deciding where to go next. In a way, he was a minimalist before folks began applying that term to music. Mal Waldron was one of the first pianists to draw on Thelonious Monk's economical keyboard style, back when a lot of folks thought Monk was too quirky to spawn any followers. Waldron's never sounded much like Monk, though he's played a lot of his music in a duo with saxophonist Steve Lacy. On Waldron's new trio album, Our Colleen's a Treasure, on the Soul Note label, he explicitly evokes Monk a couple of times. The melody of his ballad, Chez Pascal, nods to Monk's tune, Ruby, My Dear. One obvious difference between Waldron and Monk is how their music feels. Monk's use of space makes his stuff light and airy. Waldron can be playful too, but he sometimes sounds like he's brooding on the keys. He can seem a little obsessive, but that's okay. By the way, that's Leonard Jones on bass and Sangoma Everett on drums. Mal Waldron is one of those lucky jazz musicians who's been able to record dozens and dozens of records on lots of labels all over the world. That exposure has its downside. He's put out so many albums, even fans take new ones for granted. But his new record reminded this longtime fan how fresh his approach still sounds after 35 years.
Kevin Whitehead is a freelance writer based in New York. He reviewed Our Colleen's a Treasure by Mal Waldron on the Soul Note label. If you have any comments about Fresh Air, call our toll-free listener line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblitis, Richard Parker, and Thad Kirk. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the rise of fundamentalism in America and around the world. We talk with Martin Marty, one of America's foremost religion scholars. He's editing a five-volume series on the impact of fundamentalist movements within Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.